Hello, welcome back to TL Talks Podcast. I am TL. It's good to have you. So starting off with TL Talks Thought of the Day, my Thought of the Day for this week has to do with grammar. So as you all know, there's a lot of improper, incorrect, bad grammar everywhere in our world, whether it be some kind of team or company putting out a post and that has something misspelled or, spelled incorrectly as far as, for example, the word there can be spelled T-H-E-I-R, T-H-E-Y apostrophe R-E, T-H-E-R-E. Those are three different ways to say it. They're all said the same way, but they mean three different things. So you could say over there as in a direction, T-H-E-R-E. You could say their team, T-H-E-I-R, is showing possession. And then their, T-H-E-Y apostrophe R-E, is shortened for they are. So, they're a bad team. The way to correct yourself for that, or kind of fact check yourself for they are, is to say it out loud. Does this fit for saying they are? If it does, you can shorten it to there and spell it that way. But anyways, the reason I'm bringing it up is because if you're seeing stuff online, you'll see a lot of bad grammar, whether it be somebody's personal post on Facebook or Twitter, whatever the fuck. A lot of just bad grammar everywhere. And a lot of people don't give a shit. And that's totally fine, I guess. But here's the thing. And I think for me, it's more about accuracy. Everybody's built differently. Everybody's raised differently. For me, it's about accuracy. So whatever you're telling me, I want that to be accurate. Just like I want, when I'm dealing with people in my life, I want their yes to mean yes and their no to mean no. When they're writing something, if you write something on Facebook and your grammar is so fucking horrible that I need to strain my brain to try to understand what you're trying to say, that's a problem. And that happens. I'm not exaggerating. That happens. There's literally people that write a paragraph in a Facebook post, and I literally don't know what the fuck they're trying to say. That's a problem. So it's a pet peeve of mine. It usually, fortunately for me, only time I really deal with it is when I see other people's posts. And I get annoyed temporarily, but doesn't ruin my day or anything. But the only time it really involves me is if it's like a team or association that I'm associated with and their posts have bad grammar in them. Drives me crazy. And so here's my two cents on that. If you are a professional organization and you post things on social media and they're not spelled correctly and they have poor grammar, that looks very poorly on you. It looks like you don't really care about accuracy. You don't proofread your stuff before you post it. You don't really care about being accurate. You don't care about seeming legitimate. You don't care about looking like you're educated. It's just very bush league, in my opinion. And so when it happens, when it's involved with me, I'm embarrassed about it. When it's involved with just people that I see, it is what it is. It's just, it's a losing battle. I'm never going to cure, the world's grammar problems. And so it's a losing battle. But it does drive me crazy. And as it pertains to people that consider themselves professionals or people that are running an organization, whatever degree that is, if you have a post that's out there for the public to consume and it has bad grammar in it, it just looks horrible, man. It's really not that much to ask for. If you're not great with grammar, that's fine. In my opinion, you should get better. You should try to improve your grammar for yourself. But if you don't care about that, then, and you know that you're not that great at grammar, you should have people proofread your shit so that when it goes out to the public, it doesn't look bad on you. All right, moving on. So let's talk Browns. You guys had the treat of doing a recap for two games, the Bills and the Steelers, because those games happened in between two podcasts. So there's no game that happened since then. Obviously, it was Sunday, then Thursday. And so the only game coming up that we haven't covered is the Dolphins. So Browns have won two games in a row, which is awesome. I definitely expect them to beat the Dolphins. I see the game going one of two ways. Either we're going to beat the brakes off them, or Fitzpatrick's going to make it interesting, and it's going to be a little bit of a shootout, but the Browns still win. So either way, I think the Browns win. Either it's going to be a complete blowout. And my best case scenario for the Browns is that the whole Myles Garrett thing kind of galvanizes our crew, and they play harder for each other, and we just, you know, play good football the rest of the season and win a lot of games. And so that's pretty much, you know, what I'm hoping for. But yeah, we're playing the Miami Dolphins. They're one of the worst teams in the league. They have won a couple games recently, but they're still not very good. We are better in every way, even without Myles Garrett. And so I think the cool thing for me is I think not only have we won one or last two games, Baker Mayfield has thrown multiple touchdowns in the last two games, which is what we've been waiting for all season. I think that trend will continue. I think this is the first game where he could throw a lot of touchdowns, like four or five. And so that's just the reality of it. I read yesterday, I think it was yesterday, that the Dolphins just put two of their DBs on IR. And so I was feeling great about this game before they said that. But now that they said that, I'm like, Jesus, this should be like taking candy from a kid. So I'm really looking forward to that game. I have a couple friends going to the game, so that's really cool. They're going to send me some pictures of them having a good time. And it's going to be a really, real interesting to see how the Browns look without Myles Garrett. And I can't wait to, you know, watch another win. My little two cents about the Browns before I move on to Ohio State is the Browns. Here's my closing thoughts on the Myles Garrett thing. They just announced today that Myles Garrett, his suspension will be upheld. So he's out for this entire season and possibly more of next season. They reduced Pouncey's suspension from three games to two games, and that was about it. So I'm not surprised, but let me tell you, the NFL is really pissing me off because it's very obvious to me. A couple of things are obvious. One thing that's obvious to me is that they don't care about player safety. The reason they don't care about player safety is because Thursday football games happen. They schedule them intentionally because it's all about money. If they care about player safety, they realize that playing a game on Sunday and a game on Thursday is too much to ask. And it's hard on players' bodies, and it's just selfish. So since they don't care about player safety, they're going to continue to schedule Thursday games. There's going to, you know, it's going to continue to be all about money. And it's just very unfortunate. The second thing about the NFL that pisses me off is that it's a very, what do they say, CYOA, I think it is, cover your own ass. It's very pretty much how the NFL is run, and I think it's kind of part of our society. But the reason that the whole Brown/Myles Garrett thing went down the way it went down is because it's all about exposure. That game was on national television. It was a Thursday game, so it was the only game on. So the world saw it, and it was worst-case scenario, you know. He removed his helmet, hit him with it, looked horrible, barbaric, the whole nine. And so since there was that much exposure on it, the league felt the peer pressure to come down hard on Myles Garrett. So the problem I have with that is your punishment shouldn't be dictated based on exposure. Your punishment should be dictated based on precedent before that, and it should be consistent. And there should be nothing, there should be no outside factors. It shouldn't be peer pressure from a team, peer pressure from fans, peer pressure from social media. It shouldn't be about exposure. It shouldn't be about you covering your own ass. It should just be a fair punishment based on what happened. So, Myles Garrett alluded to something that happened years ago. I think it was Antonio Smith and Richie Incognito. They got in a fight in the field, and one of the players pulled the other player's helmet off and hit him with it. He ended up getting suspended for three games, only one of those games being a regular season game. So even if you go to three games for Myles Garrett, that's still half of what he got, if not more. So the whole thing is ridiculous. He was way overpunished. I would have been happy if they reduced it to four games so he could at least play the last two games of the season. And I think that would have been fair because, you know, it was bad. It made the Browns look bad. It made Myles Garrett look bad. I was embarrassed as a fan. But to overpunish him like this is ridiculous. It makes me very angry. if I wasn't as big of a Browns fan as I am, I would seriously consider just not watching NFL games at all. Even though I love football as much as I do, it's getting to the point now where the combination of how they handle things, you know, refs blowing games, you know, just the culture is very, the cancel culture, all of it is just really gross to me. And so it's becoming more and more hard to swallow, maybe based on my age. Maybe as I get older, I just have less tolerance for things. But yeah, that's my two cents on the Browns. Mason Rudolph did say he did finally admit that he had a part in the fight. Myles Garrett mentioned that there was a racial slur said, which they couldn't find any proof of, so we'll never know if that's true. But yeah, the whole thing's unfortunate, but we just have to move on. And, you know, like they say in interviews, you have who you have, and you have to, you know, do the best with what you have. So we got to move on. Moving on to Ohio State. Ohio State played Rutgers on Saturday, beat them 56-21. A little bit bummed they gave up 21, but it's still decisive victory, and so that's all good. We get Chase Young back this week, thank the Lord, because we're playing Penn State this week. So our last three games will probably be Penn State, the team up north, and then the championship game might be against Minnesota, but Minnesota just lost, and so I'm not sure about that. But this is the game that us Buckeyes fans have been waiting for. You know, most of the season, Ohio State was undefeated. Penn State was undefeated. Penn State made it as high as number four. Ohio State made it as high as number one. And so we were on this, like, collision course for these two undefeated teams in the Big Ten to clash with everything on the line. Well, just like Wisconsin, Penn State blew it. They lost the game before they played Ohio State. So now it's not nearly as – it's very anticlimactic for the game, but it is what it is. They lost, and so that the fact that they lost before they played us is proof to me that just like Wisconsin and whoever else in the Big Ten, they're not really ready to be that high on the food chain as far as these really elite teams in the nation. So I expect Ohio State to win. I'm not sure how it's going to go. I think much like the Browns game, it could be just a blowout, you know, just like the Wisconsin game was. Or it could be a battle, you know, kind of a shootout, and then Ohio State wins, you know, by a shorter margin. But either way, I think Ohio State will win. How it goes, you know, we'll see. So that's Ohio State. Moving on to fantasy before I get into my interview. My interview this week was with Coach Rick Rasmussen. He's the head coach of the Utah Falcons. He's been coaching for about 30 years. He's been somewhat of a mentor to me over the years, and so it was really cool to have him on. We've talked a lot over the years, but it was cool to have you know, the interview and kind of pick his brain a little bit. But yeah, for fantasy football, so what I'm giving you right now is a list of players you can pick up in fantasy football as free agents. I did the homework for you. These are all players that had a good week last week, and they're available in less than 75%, or sorry, more. They're available in 75%. I said that wrong. So when you look at them on fantasy, it'll say how many percent owns them, right? If the player is 75% owned or higher, then I don't put them on this list because obviously there's not a very good chance they're going to be available. But if they're 70% or lower, then I put them on this list. So these are guys that realistically could be available in your league. And if you're trying to, you know, plug in for a bye week or an injury, or you're just kind of weak at a certain position, these are guys you could look at. So they are quarterback Driscoll, Sam Darnold, and Haskins. They all had solid games last week. Running back Pollard, Edwards from Baltimore, and Cohen. Receivers are Randall Cobb, Parker from Miami, Samuel for the 49ers, and Renfro for the Raiders. Tight ends are Rudolph, Brait from Tampa Bay, and Griffin. Defenses are Cleveland, Atlanta, and Baltimore. And IDPs are, I think his name's Davis. I want to say he's from the Broncos. White from the Bucks. Buda Baker again for Arizona. He's had a monster season this season. And then Warner for the 49ers for IDPs. That's what I got for fantasy. But yeah, let's get into the interview, guys. So like I said, interviews with Rick Rasmussen. Awesome coach. Kind of legendary coach for the Utah Falcons. He's the head coach for them. Been with them for 6 or 7 years since they were formed. And a really cool interview, really great guy, really awesome coach. and also a pretty cool guy as far as, you know, his background with military and some of his, you know, point of views on things. So without further ado, this is my interview with Rick Rasmussen, head coach of the Utah Falcons.
I'd like to thank Rick Rasmussen for joining me on TL Talks podcast. Rick is the head coach of the Utah Falcons, who are one of the best teams in the nation, definitely one of the best teams in the WNFC. So I know you're a busy guy, Rick. I've been waiting for you to tell me you're retired, but you're still not retired. And so I appreciate you taking out the time to join me.
Well, thank you for having me, and appreciate what you're doing for the sport.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, as you know, I start off all my interviews with kind of how we know each other, and then a little bit of your background. So, how we know each other? I've been coaching women's football for about 6 or 7 years, and when I was coaching my former team, when we first started out, we kind of were an independent team, because we weren't really in a league yet, and we're trying to, you know, just put a schedule together. And so the good news, bad news was part of that schedule we put together was included the Utah Falcons. And so I remember one of the first times we played each other, we were undefeated that season, as our first season, and you guys were obviously undefeated because you usually are. And we were playing in Utah. And that was one of many of my first lessons in humility when I played, you know, coached that first game in Utah. I think this final score was somewhere around lower 60s to zero. It's kind of a rough game, you know, worst case scenario from our standpoint. But that's how we met each other originally, you know, coaching against each other. We probably played against each other, I'd say somewhere around 6 to 8 times, you know, with the home and away, with my former team and then my current team, the Denver Bandits. So coached against each other 6 to 8 times, and then we've coached with each other at least once. There was one time where I flew out to Vegas to join you for one of the Hall of Fame games, and that was an enjoyable experience. It was cool to, you know, hang out with some of the coaches and get to know some of the players better. So we've been able to stay in touch over the years. Me and you have kind of had our ups and downs. We don't need to really get into the downs, but I like to think that currently we're at a pretty good spot, you know, as far as, you know, our friendship and, you know, talking and staying in touch. And so that's how I see it. So would you say that all that's accurate so far?
Yeah, I don't remember any downs, but then, you know, I've got memory issues, so... And I'm one of those people that really lets bygones be bygones. So,
good.
I certainly can agree that I may not be the easiest person in the world to get along with, but such is life.
Yeah, I gotcha. So, next thing we get into is your background. So, I know a little bit of your background. Me and you have talked, you know, for hours over the years about football and life. And I've appreciated those conversations, but I know a little bit of your background as far as the military and what you currently do for work, but there's also a lot of things I don't know. And so if you don't mind,
I'll fill you in on the parts that I'm comfortable on filling you in on.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, absolutely.
Obviously, you're right. I came from the military. I was lucky enough to go to the Air Force Academy at age 17, and that shaped, I think, my life as a whole. I left the, I was a fighter pilot. I left the military in 1986, and I went into the FBI. I retired from them, after about 22 years, just under 22 years.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, I've been doing police oversight, wherein I investigate allegations of misconduct against the police, and that's what I'm still currently doing. Fingers crossed, I'll retire here in about 2.5 years, and shoot hoops and play catch with my grandchildren.
Gotcha. So, if you don't mind, I'm going to ask you some specific questions about your background, and you can, you know, answer them or not answer them. It's up to you, but nothing too crazy. So usually what I like to know about people is, you know, kind of where they're from originally, right? Because I know obviously you live in Utah now, but I'm not sure if you're originally from Utah.
Or no, I'm from Southern California. I grew up in Long Beach.
Gotcha.
Like I said, I left home at age 17 to go to the Air Force Academy. I never moved back. So after California, it was Colorado, Mississippi, Texas, Mississippi, New Mexico, Florida, Las Vegas, Washington, D.C., and then here.
Gotcha. Okay. So those were all different orders when you're in the military, right?
And the military and the FBI and whatnot. Yeah, I mean, that obviously doesn't account for various places I went temporarily and, you know, did various work assignments. But so, yeah, I've lived in a lot of different places, and I've visited a whole lot more. So came from a very athletic background. My family was very sports oriented. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we were, we were a poor family growing up in the outskirts of L.A., and the weather's good, and sports are generally free or a lot more close to free at the time. So I wasn't playing sports. I was at the beach. And, so just kind of a unusual type thing. I have obviously three adult grown children and up to seven grandkids at this point. So somewhere along the line, I've gotten old.
Gotcha. Well, you may be older in years, but I wouldn't say you slip much mentally from what I can tell.
Yeah, I've got a couple extra pounds around the waistline, but yeah, I think the mental acuity is still there, so that helps with with my professional and personal coaching life, in that I enjoy sports. I'm obviously still involved, at least through this year, and then we'll see what the future has. I'm getting a little banged up in the old age. My professional life has not been kind on my body. So, I don't know. I don't think I'll slow down. Hopefully I'll continue to read and stay quasi-sharp intellectually, and we'll go from there.
Yeah. That was going to be my next question. I was going to ask you, what do you attribute your mental acuity to, as far as staying sharp? Is it reading? Do you think some of it's genetics, or what would you say?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm probably one of the only guys that probably got carded when I wanted a beer at age 30. On my father's side, we're Scandinavian. Mm-hmm. So I think we look younger than we actually are. Like I mentioned before, we weren't very well off as kids, so I was a big user of the public library system, and I just recently had a birthday, and I think I got 9 different books for my birthday.
Okay.
So I love to read. I'll read almost anything, and helps you keep sharp and teaches you stuff.
Yeah, for sure. There's a lot of wisdom in that. So, trying to think if I'm satisfied with your background before we can move on.
That's probably all you're going to get. So,
Southern
move on to more interesting topics.
Yeah, military. You've lived. I'm not sure about you. I lived in Mississippi as well briefly when I was in the military, and I was not a fan of that state.
It's funny. I got there in the late 70s. Coming from L.A., going to college in Colorado.
Yeah.
Drove in with my first car I'd ever owned, so obviously I pampered it. Expecting a child. It was a bit of a culture shock. Things are a little different. But, you know, after maybe a year, yeah. I got to where I really liked Mississippi. And I like the Deep South in general. I like the people. I like their pace is a whole lot more mature than the rest of us. I remember one time we were driving in Florida. I think we were going through Lake City, which is sort of in the middle, you know, where the long part goes up to the Panhandle part, like, mm-hmm. if you can say dead center of a state that's shaped like that. Went in to get McDonald's for my little boys. I only had two sons at the time. They were little. Mm-hmm. Walked in, wanted a Happy Meal or whatever it was at the time. They go, okay, have a seat. We'll bring it out to you. I go, well, you know, wait a second. This is McDonald's. And the guy leaned across the counter. He goes, you're not from these parts, are you? And then I looked behind the counter, and everybody working there was in their 60s, which isn't old any longer, but at the time it was pretty old. And the guy just said, son, I know you're not from around here. I can tell because you haven't got a good accent. He goes, but just go enjoy your little boys. We'll bring your food out to you when it's ready. And I really grew to appreciate that way of life, where some things were a lot more important than other things. So I like the South. We played in New Orleans last year. I loved that. Had a wonderful thunderstorm that evening. I mean, just, well, I guess we had a thunderstorm at the end of the game, too, but that's another story. But, I mean, it was just a spectacular thunderstorm, and I just, you know, harken back to my younger days. I really like the South. It's a good place. But, yeah, I don't think it's for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, I was there. I was only there temporarily. I was there for A school, and, you know, I was in some town in Mississippi. I think it was called Meridian. And, yep. You know, kind of in the middle of nowhere, not much yep. to do. And so I was kind of, you know, I was a younger guy. And so
right.
I was probably just being spoiled, you know, wanting more stuff to do. But
Yeah. I mean, I live just north of Meridian. Meridian's a Naval Air Station. And I was mm-hmm. at Columbus Air Force Base going through pilot training. So bumped into a lot of the Navy guys because, like everybody else, that first year it's a little difficult when you're not from the South, trying to fit in and, you know, get used to the humidity and whatnot and the bugs. Mm-hmm. I like it. Like I said, Terry, I enjoyed my time down there. So it was but I've enjoyed my time everywhere. I was stationed once in just outside of Las Cruces in a place called Alamogordo, New Mexico, mm-hmm. which we nicknamed Alamogordo at the time because we were young, and I grew to love that place, too. It was very, very interesting. So I've been all over, met all sorts of people.
Yeah. Do you think, do you attribute you enjoying everywhere you've lived just to mostly mindset? Because, you know, I think a lot of things are, you know, mind over matter. Do you think it was just more of you embracing the new place and, you know, the positives that can be drawn from that to
yeah.
why
you know, I grew up in the same bedroom. I spent 17 years in the same bedroom with my three brothers. You know, my feet next to my brother's head, my brother's feet next to my younger twin brother's bunk bed in this little room. And so I was very used to living conditions that weren't, you know, primo. I didn't have any expectations on mansions and I don't to this day. Mm-hmm. So, but I think the reason I was able to enjoy all of my experiences, like you touched on, mm-hmm. was mindset. This is where I am in my life. This is what I'm doing in my life. And this is where I'm having to do it. So, I always embrace the local culture. You know, frankly, one of the biggest culture changes for me mm-hmm. was my final move, which was to Utah, because Utah's a, you know, it's a unique state in its own way. And so, you know, but I remember when I first got here, my older brother came down to visit mm-hmm. and stayed with me and remarked that, you know, there's a basketball hoop in every driveway. He goes, I think I'm going to move here. And ended up moving here and coached forever. I think he won six states. open your mind and embrace it, but it's kind of...
Hey, Rick.
Yeah.
Whatever the last 5 seconds of what you said, the phone cut out a little bit. So you're saying that your brother moved to Utah and he coached basketball for a long time. And then
yeah,
whatever you said right after that.
Yeah, and so I think, you know, after Rand came and visited, he noted the basketball hoops, and that's part of the culture out here is the athletics and being outdoors and being healthy and all those kind of things. So that eased that transition. So, you know, I think that... if you embrace new things with an open mind, you're mm-hmm. probably going to find a lot of satisfaction.
Mm. Did you say that he won, like, 5 state championships?
Yeah, I think he won 6 state championships. He coached girls basketball and baseball. He was a professional baseball player. By trade, he passed away just 2 months ago. So, but he really loved it here, raised his kids here. Just, you know, I don't know, half a yeah. mile, 3/4 of a mile from where I live. And so it's good. Utah, like I said, is as unique as Mississippi or New Mexico were unique. You know, talking about the attitude to excel or succeed in your new environment, I think that is based upon you, the person who decides, I'm going to make the most out of what I have facing me. I think that's a family attribute that all of us have.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, I was going to say, I didn't know about that. That's pretty cool. I mean, you're a really awesome coach yourself. You've had a lot of success as a football coach, and then to know that your brother was also a coach in basketball, and he had a ton of success. That's a pretty good bloodline you guys have. So would you say that kind of goes across the board with all your siblings as far as just kicking ass in life? Or,
you know, I think we all are different. I think Rand and I are a little bit more of type A personalities, where I think my younger twin brothers, who are, you know, they're both over 6'4", they don't have to be the hard-charging go-getters. But yeah, Rand and I both did that. I think that comes from our father, mm-hmm. who was the same way. But we're all individuals. We all have our own likes and our things that we excel at. Both of my younger brothers are great at things that I just can't even do. I mean, I just can't do. And those guys just are really something else. So, you know, we're just different, and I think in life I learned early, you play the cards you're dealt, and you don't whine about the cards you're not dealt. That's just not part of me as an individual. And that which I was taught by my father and my mother, obviously, mm-hmm. I think was reinforced by my experience flying airplanes. You make all the excuses you want, but at the end of the day, you either won or you lost. So stop making excuses. So excuse making has never been a big part of me. I've been on the good and bad end of bad calls in football games. Mm-hmm. Never once have I blamed a loss on a bad call. And sure, like every other human, I never attributed a win to a bad call that went my direction, because mm-hmm. I mean, that's just not cool. But you know, I think they exist in life, and it's part of life. And if you're going to whine about your circumstances, you know, whatever it may be, whether you only have 25 on your roster and you're jealous that someone else has 53, mm-hmm. or you know that your players are small and everybody else's players are huge,
mm-hmm.
I mean, That's what you signed up for. Quit whining about it. Put on your big boy britches and go. So, you know, that's just always been my view of life.
Gotcha.
Yeah, so last thing I want to ask you about as far as background, Rick, before I get into more specific questions, would be your playing and coaching experience. So I know you've coached for a long time.
And yeah, I coached for a long time. I played at my high school. I played for my squadron at the academy. I played when I was in the Air Force. In fact, my first assignment was basically decided by the squadron commander, where I went through pilot training wanting to win the wing championship in football. And so he said, hey, how about you stay here and become an instructor pilot for a little bit, and then you go on your merry way. But in the meanwhile, let's win the championship. He reminded me a little bit of the guy off of Apocalypse Now who wanted to surf. I think it was Robert Duvall's character. When they were landing on their air assault, he noticed the curls of the waves, and all he could think about was surfing that point. So I coached, started out when I was still in the Air Force. My oldest son, I think, was four. Mm-hmm. And so I fibbed to get him. Fib is a tactful way of saying I was less than truthful about his age.
Yeah.
And had him play, I think he had to be five to play T-ball. And, because I wasn't very old, I couldn't remember his birth date exactly, so he started a little early. I started coaching his T-ball team, and, I remember one funny thing. We had one of the players on our team, they're 5 and 6 years old, mm-hmm. and this one outlier four-year-old. And you can't keep them focused for more than 2 seconds. And
yeah, good luck.
And his mom was she was one of those parents or one of those fans at the stadium that screams down to you, why'd you call that play, just after you lost 2 yards? Where you want to turn around and say, because we're much better at 2nd and 12 than we are at 2nd and 3, you stupid idiot. But she just wouldn't let it go. There was a pop fly. The jets were flying overhead. The little boy was looking up at the jets flying overhead. The ball hit him in the head. it was just hilarious. It was perfect. There you go, Mom. Just sit back down. Let your son enjoy the game. And then I started, when I got to Utah and things settled down a little bit professionally, I started coaching Little League football here. And from there, the high school asked me to go up and start coaching high school football, and in an odd way, it's how I ended up on the Falcons. So I coached at 3 high schools here, suffered an injury, had to get surgery, so I stopped coaching for 4 or 5 years. I was in the gym just minding my own business, and a player for the Utah Jinx was there who had been a teacher at the high school where I had coached.
Mm-hmm.
She just kept bugging me to come and help them. And I just said, because I'd finally gotten out of coaching, that phase of my life was over, but this player was extremely persistent.
Yeah.
So I finally just said, screw it. I'll come to practice and help you one time. Went to practice, and I've been there ever since.
Rest is history.
Yeah. Huh. So I guess this will be our 7th year with the Falcons, and I did the Jinx, I think, for 2 or 3 years. I can't recall. Mm-hmm. Coached with the Jinx for a couple years. Then we parted ways and started our own team, like happens so much in women's football, because we felt like we could do it differently.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to use the word better, but differently. And so
I would use the word better.
Well, I mean, if you go with accomplishments, yeah, it ended up being better, but that wasn't the vision in the beginning. It was to do it properly or closer to properly.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we were able to do. Very lucky. There were 8 of us that decided to form the team, and we've gone from there.
Mm. So when you say you grew up playing sports, when you first started talking about that, was that football that you were talking about, or different?
Yeah, basketball? No, I played, obviously as a kid, back in the day, you used to play all the sports. football, basketball, and baseball. And I played all three as a child, and then in high school, I ended up playing football, wrestling, and half a season of baseball, which is odd because, like I said, my older brother was a professional baseball player. And I remember asking him, what the heck? And he goes, well, you got to see the seams when it's leaving the pitcher's fingers. What? What are you talking about? What seams? What fingers? I'm just trying to find the ball on the way in, which is amusing because, you know, I had 20/15 vision. It was a huge advantage when I flew airplanes, but I just wasn't built the same as my brother was built when it came to certain things in sports. He, you know, things that he took for granted were, you know, just light years ahead of people like you and me, just, you know, so. Until I knew early that I was a good athlete, but I knew that I never had the illusion that I was a great athlete, you know, because my brother and his friends, his Pony League team, which are 13 and 14-year-olds, they won the world championship. Their starting nine, eight played Major League Baseball, one played in the NFL. So that's nine pretty good little boys that, you know, that you grow up around and you say, okay, I better read more. I better do better in the classroom because I'm not going to make a living throwing or catching a ball.
We're not the same. I gotcha.
Yeah, we're not the same. And so it was good in that it awoken me to the fact that everybody wants to play in the NBA or Major League Baseball or the NFL. But by about age 11, I knew, okay, you're going to have to do something different. You're never going to do it like that. So, which is better than most kids. So, I've got a grandson right now that's in the Olympic Development Program for soccer, and I constantly tell his parents, remember, he's going to make his living based upon what he learns, not based upon what he can do on the pitch. So, but you know, it's just interesting as we grow.
Would you say that out of the sports you played, you were best at football?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. I was the best in football. But again, like I said, I was a good athlete. Now, I went to a huge high school. My high school, I think, had 4,500 kids in a three-year high school. And we were in an 18 league. And I think our furthest road trip was to Compton. And that was, you know, if they didn't have all the gates you had to go through to get to the field, it was maybe a 15-minute drive. So most of our games by bus were 15 or less minutes to get to our games because the city was just so big, you know. If you've been to L.A., you know, it starts in the middle of the city and then it just flows outward like a lava flow as far as the eye can see. I didn't really have a good understanding of how big it was until I flew in there as a young pilot and came over the mountains from the east. It was a clear night and you could, you know, you go from the desert with no lights over these mountains where you can, as far as you can see horizon to horizon are street lights. You know, okay, this is LA. I don't know where in LA it is, but holy smokes, I mean, it's a big city with a lot of people. So it was just different growing up in a huge city with perfect weather and, at the time, just a great place to be born and raised. I'm not sure it's the same today, but it certainly was then.
Yeah. So how long have you been coaching football total?
Oh, my gosh. Including Little League, probably 30 years.
Okay, that's what I estimated. I wasn't sure if that's accurate or not.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it's about right. Maybe a little bit longer because I think I started coaching shortly after I got here, and I was 31 when I got here. So, yeah, 30 years anyway.
Okay.
And I've enjoyed every season I've coached, so it's been a lot of fun.
Gotcha. All right, so, yeah, I wanted to get into some specific stuff about excellence, leadership, and trust. So my last podcast guest was Rodney Lacy,
who's the head coach of the St. Louis Slam. Awesome guy. We got to have a pretty good discussion about, you know, how he kind of runs his program, and he made a really good point to ask him about leadership, because it's obvious that, you know, the vibe on his team is pretty positive. And he alluded to, you know, trust being a key factor with his players, and, you know, the communication between them, and the players knowing at the end of the day, you know, the coaches have their best interests in mind. They're trying to put them in his position to not only succeed, but also, you know, to keep them safe physically. So what would you say about that, Rick? I'm interested to see what your take is on leadership and trust, because, you know, everybody's got, you know, opinions are like assholes. Everybody's got them, but and there's people that probably like you and don't like you, but your results, specifically with the Falcons, are undeniable. You guys have lost like 4 games in 6 years, and they're just, like I said, a top team, top five in the nation, in my opinion. And so since you guys, your guys' program is as awesome as it is, it's very obvious that a lot of the culture things are the way they're supposed to be. And so what would you say from a leadership and trust perspective as far as, you know, how you guys are able to kind of get everybody on the same page, you know what I mean, and work for one goal?
Sure. Well, first off, let me retort to one thing you said. Some people probably like me and some people probably dislike me.
Yeah.
I think that's true, and I think both sides are justified in their approach and their feelings. So that never has affected me. But like I said, I do have empathy for both parties, the ones that like and the ones that do not like, and I think they're both justified. So I just wanted to get that out there.
Right.
So in case anybody thinks that by disliking me, they're hurting my feelings. Like I told my team, well, it's been a couple of years ago. I can't remember what came up. I said something like, hey, if I or any of the coaches have hurt your feelings, get new feelings. And we went from there. My leadership style for our team is maybe a little bit different in that the team was built, not just by me, but by many others, to include one aspect of the team, in that the team polices itself. The team is accountable to itself well before they're accountable to me. I, you know, my experience as a fighter pilot is, you know, people say, oh, you came from the military, so, you know, it's yes sir, no sir, three bags full.
Yeah.
And that may be true in at least two of the other services. I think maybe the Marine Corps and the Army, that's probably exactly how they have to do it. The Air Force does not do it that way, and I'm unfamiliar with the Navy. But the reason we don't do it that way is because in the Air Force, the folks that go forward on the pointy tip of the spear are officers, whereas in the Marine Corps and the Army, it's a young officer leading a group of younger troops into a real bad situation. So ultimately, that type of leadership, that style of leadership of take that hill, works real well there, and it's the only way to do it there. And the Army and the Marines have got it down perfectly. The Air Force, you're flying with guys that are your peers, both rank-wise, sometimes they're your superiors, and experience-wise, many of them are the same as you, and most of them you went to college with. Mm-hmm. So take that hill when your wingman is twice as smart as you are. That doesn't really cut the mustard. They just look at you with, yeah, no, we're not doing that type of approach. So you have to convince a number of highly educated, smart people to do something insanely dangerous. So I've adopted that approach with our football team, in that the true leadership of the team lies with the team. The coaching staff is there to provide the roadmaps. You remember those old atlases, Coach, before you had your cell phone? That's
right.
What we give them. We give them the atlas that has all the roads on it, and we tell them what turn right at the next street. But if they opt to turn left, that's where the team's going, is left. So we really focus on team ownership by the team, camaraderie. The one lesson we as a coaching staff, and I mean we as a coaching staff, embrace is team. That is the first, second, and third priority. The starters, we obviously, as it's been alluded to on your program by at least one of your previous guests, you just don't run out of gas. There's 50 of them. Well, there's 50 of us because somebody's having a good time and they're telling their friends. But
yeah, that's true.
The starters are black unit. Mm-hmm. They're taught from day one that your job is to go onto the field, do your job, get off the field, and then be the biggest cheerleaders when blue and silver are on the field.
Mm-hmm.
And that a failure for black is not yielding a touchdown or throwing an interception or missing a tackle. It's the fact that you didn't perform to your level, and it cost blue and silver playing time. Because for all of the discussion that some people believe, when you have 53 people who are all paying to play, there mm-hmm. is an expectation that they get to play.
Yeah.
And so it's hard as a coaching staff to provide that expectation, that playing time. Mm. And so I would argue it's a whole lot harder than having 30 players.
Yeah, yeah.
Does it have its advantages? Absolutely it has its advantages. We don't have to run our starters on our special teams. We don't have to have players. We don't have to have players play both ways. Mm-hmm. So it's an advantage. But it's a disadvantage in that every player on the team, especially at home games, they want to show off in front of their friends and families just like the starters do. So mm-hmm. from a coaching point of view, I would argue having a large roster presents as many or more problems as having a intermediate-sized roster. Ideally, I think if every team was limited to 30 players, we would still be as good as we are because mm-hmm. obviously our top players 30, can compete yeah. with anybody.
Right.
But having a large roster does give you different problems. So, I heard the Reno coach in his interview, and he seems a little hot under the collar. I think we played him 7 times, and and rightfully, he can be disappointed. But I know that based on his interview, mm-hmm. that if he's interested in playing us in the preseason, we'd love to do it, and we'll only play 30 players or whatever the limits on the number of players that he would like to have so that we can put it to rest, that it's not the 53 versus the 30. It's the players on the field at the time. It's military history will teach you. It's not the guy with the biggest army. It's the guy with the best army at the point of attack. You can have 10 million guys, but if 5 million of them are in Siberia and the fight's in the Urals, you're going to lose. So, there are various lessons that life can teach you on that. But I think the leadership on our team is really solid. The players take it to heart. We've dismissed one player and this is our 7th year, mm-hmm. and the team dismissed her. Not the coaches, not the ownership, not the leadership. The players dismissed her. And that's it. And I think we've had in our, coming up on 7 years, 2 players who have ever taken snaps in a game who've gone on and played for another team. Just 2. Which mm-hmm. isn't bad when you have such a large team. So, if we had 53 on our roster, but we were only playing 22 and mm-hmm. scoring 50 points a game, rightfully people could be upset. But that would have been reflected in the fact on year 2, we wouldn't have had 50. We would have been down to 25 just like everybody else. Mm-hmm. So the team has built something here unique enough to where it attracts other players. We've had 2 preseason. We're just starting to get together. We get together once a month. We've mm-hmm. had 2 practices so far, and I think we've had 19 rookie players show up to both of our practices. So, you know, that's, I think that reflects upon what the team has built, and much beyond, you know, a very good record. Mm-hmm. The fact that the girls are coming and having fun and feeling empowered and learning lessons that they can use for the rest of their lives, no matter what lies ahead, is a reflection of the program more than anything else.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, speaking of previous podcasts, Rick, I know, you know, since we had been talking recently, you knew that I was going to be starting a podcast, and then I wasn't sure if you checked it out. So I asked you through text, and you're like, yeah, you know, send it to me. I'll listen to it on Sunday.
Yeah, I think I've listened to three of them.
Okay. Yeah, so I sent you the website, and you were able to listen to a few of them. And so I think your perspective is interesting as it pertains, not because you're some kind of podcaster, but because of your background, right? So you were in the FBI for a long time. You currently, you know, work in law enforcement. And so as it pertains to specifically, I guess, I wouldn't say, you know, like grilling people, but like interviewing, right? So if you're, yep, trying to interview somebody and you're trying to get information out of them or have a good conversation, I think it would be fair to assume that, you know, you know a few things about that. So for me,
that was my forte in the FBI. That's what I did.
Exactly.
I mean, I've sat across the table from, you know, guys who have kidnapped children, guys that have killed people, you know, just all sorts of different types. And your objective in those interviews is to get the information you need to put him away. So, interviewing is something that I do take pride in. I think that your podcast, you've done an exceptional job. I don't think interviewing is easy or comes natural to everyone. So,
I appreciate that. I appreciate that. Yeah. So, as you know, I'm pretty new at this. I'm decent with conversation in general. You know, I can usually throw a few words together, not so like an idiot. But interviewing, as you know, is a little bit different, right? So as far as how you structure it, how you ask your questions. I have a buddy named Ryan Lentzel who used to be, I think he did ESPN Radio in Ohio. And so he's given me some pretty good advice about my podcast and, you know, do's and don'ts. And he's given me some good feedback about things that I can do a little bit differently in my interviews. And so what I'm trying to do right now is transition to what, you know, from what comes natural to what might be better, you know, for the listener and for the interviews. And so as is anything in life, you know, you're going to have, you know, the learning curve in the beginning, you know, before you get down to the gym, but I'll get there eventually. The previous podcast, sounds like you enjoyed them. I promise you, Rick, that I'm not running a Falcon smear campaign. You know, my guests, I've asked some questions, you know, about, you know, life and football, and some of them have played you like I have. And, you know, of course, like I said, everybody's got opinions, good or bad, but, in my opinion, you know, I have nothing but respect for your team. I love your players. They're all awesome women. You're obviously,
I think that whenever anyone, publicly states their opinion and backs it up with, and I'm using air quotes here, facts, mm-hmm, you've got to remember that, yes, what you presented are facts, but they're not all of the facts, and therefore arriving at a conclusion based on three or four facts while omitting six or seven facts will allow you to sound exactly right and spot on. Mm-hmm. But it ignores the rest of the evidence.
Yeah.
And you can't make that mistake to ignore the rest of the evidence. It's easy for anyone to blame an outcome on something that didn't go their way. Mm-hmm. It's harder. I remember after we lost to Pittsburgh, and that was a heck of a game. Lost by 5 points. You know, you look across the sideline, there's Franco Harris. I mean, the stadium was magnificent. The game was magnificent. I felt we lost that game because of me, not because I didn't call the right plays or not because we didn't run the right thing on defense or any of those things. We lost that game, in my opinion, and I've told my team this repeatedly, because I have them squeezing the bat a little too tight before they went up to, you know, take their cuts. So the second time we played for a championship, and yes, it was a championship, whether or not it meets anybody else's definition of a championship, I don't know who the thesaurus is on the definition of championships. I've never worried about that. There are multiple leagues, multiple champions, and that's good for the sport. But the second time we played, our locker room was rolling with music. The girls were dancing. They were excited. We were very, very carefree. We had a pool party the night before, which we've done now prior to every one of our subsequent championship appearances. So we went into the games much more relaxed. No more squeezing of the bat type of thing. So, you know, I look at the opinions of people, and I listen to them more to gain insight on how their brain works so that I can help game plan against them. But by no way, shape, or form did we have our players in the right mindset when we played Pittsburgh. And as a result, a very good Pittsburgh team defeated us on the field. So that's the way it goes. They didn't cheat. They didn't have too many players. They didn't have Franco Harris. You know, those things were that didn't decide the outcome of the game. They beat us that night, and I salute them. Their quarterback, I think their last name was Horton, and a heck of a game. And they beat us. So beat us by five, and it was a fun game, and I wish that we could have played them the following weekend. But that's not the way the sport's designed. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, I think you do good on questioning. I think a big problem today with moderators or prognosticators is that they come in with an opinion and they're going to defend that opinion either by facts or by selective use of facts, whereas if you just look at all the facts, I think you can arrive at the right conclusion. But once again, this is an opinion, so you can't be wrong no matter what your opinion is. If the Denver Bandits are the best team in your mind, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. But, to slap at or take shots at or make excuses for or blame a bad outcome on an outside factor, that's not the way I was raised and it's not the way I live. So,
I gotcha. That's fair. So my next question would be about the difference between the Jinx and the Falcons. So the Jinx were around right before I started coaching women's football.
Right.
So unfortunately for me, when I started coaching, that's right when the Falcons got together and started kicking ass ever since.
Right.
And so I've been on the receiving end of a lot of those butt whoopings. But what would you say that the difference between those two teams are? Because since I've never, watched the Jinx, coached against the Jinx, I don't even think I've seen them on film, really. I can only assume, what that team looked like. But was it mostly the same players? Was it a lot different coach? Obviously, it's a different owner. I think that was one of the biggest problems with the Jinx. But from an organizational standpoint, what was the difference between those two teams?
There are, I think, two Falcons players who were on the Jinx. I think the year after we left the Jinx, there might have been 15, 16 Jinx players that came to the Falcons, and obviously the Jinx folded, I think, the next year. I think the difference is that the leadership of the team is team-based, where the leadership of the Jinx was the owner-head coach-based. And I think that that's a reflection of maybe an approach that you would take in a high school or a professional sport wherein the team owns the player. In women's football, the players pay fees. So by definition, although they may not have legal rights to it, they own the team. So the team reflects not only the theory and sense of structure that comes from the coaches, it owns the way the team is run. So if you have players that are going to teach and coach up a rookie, and every new player that's ever come to my team, whether they came from no experience or they came from another program, their biggest comment is, I'm amazed by how all the veterans spend so much time coaching up the rookies. And so I think the difference between the two teams is the fact that on the Jinx, it was run by one guy, and on the Falcons, it's run by 53 women and a couple of guys. And so it's just a slightly different approach. I think the reason we've been good, I think there are four main factors. We have some incredible athletes. They're not big. We have a couple of big athletes, but we've got some incredible athletes. Number two, we have a really solid sense of team. We assign battle buddies, but when you get sent to the fence for a fumble or screwing up, you don't go alone, you go with your battle buddy. Just to reinforce the concept of team. When we're on the road, our players, when they aren't at a team activity, can go out and do anything they want to as long as they're with their battle buddy. So we have that camaraderie that is built into the team from day one. We don't have players that go and stay at their own hotel. We don't have players that are renting Airbnbs. It's team. I think the third aspect is we're very lucky. We've been blessed with great administration from day one, from when the team was first founded to where we are today. Our administration really does a nice job of making sure that everything that can be done to make the players feel like a part of something bigger than themselves is done within financial limitations, because our travel schedule is brutal. I mean, the closest team we have to play is Vegas. That's the closest. And they're about six and a half hours away. And then it's a tie between you guys and Reno at 8 to 9 hours away. And then it's Katy Bar the door. I mean, when we go to Seattle or we go to Los Angeles or we go to San Diego, last year we went to New Orleans, those are trips. So we're on the road in a bus for a long time, so that you got to have that camaraderie, and our admin makes that work real well. Both our current and our previous admin have done as good a job as I think is being done out there. And then lastly, I think we have a solid coaching staff. What Jody does with his defense, Jody and Jasper, people comment about our triple option. Look, the triple option's been around since the late 60s. That's nothing. You know, I've even heard disparaging remarks on your program about our triple option. Then you guys need to stop it.
That's true.
But one of the biggest parts of our team is our defense. I mean, our defense is stingy. You know, when you're holding Dallas to 21 points, that's a pretty good job, because I would argue Dallas is as good as there is playing the game anywhere in the country in any league. I would pay pretty good money to watch Dallas and Boston line up and knock helmets. Those two teams are at a different level than the rest of us. I think that our defense does an exceptional job. And, it starts with Jody and Jasper and the other coaches that work on that side of the ball. and the players that adopt that idea. And then, yes, it helps that they don't have to also play fullback or they also aren't the right guard. There's no doubt about it. That gives us a bit of an advantage. But when you're giving away 40 or 50 pounds, I mean, Caleb Bruner, who I think was the defensive MVP last year in the WNFC, she can't weigh about 55. So you're doing something right as a coaching staff on that side of the ball to be able to be as effective as those 11 women are, black, blue, and silver, whenever they're on the field. So I think that our coaching staff is the fourth factor in why we've been successful. Because, you know, look, the fact remains Salt Lake City has 190,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Reno Sparks has 375,000 people. Denver has 5 million people.
Mm-hmm.
It says 8 million people. So, you know, there are, we get, and we have to work very hard, excellent athletes to come out and play with us.
Gotcha. Let's talk pet peeves, Rick. What would you say your biggest pet peeves as a football coach? What drives you crazy?
Anyone that picks their nose and eats it. That's a big one for me. I don't like booger eaters. you know, I don't know that I have a pet peeve per se, T.L. I obviously, with the way we scheme and with our lack of overall general size, turnovers are a killer for us.
Mm.
I'm not a big supporter of turnovers. Now, yeah. I don't know that there are many coaches out there that are, but you know, you never know. There could be somebody out there that's saying, yeah, we'll give them a couple turnovers and still beat their ass. That's not me. but I think my biggest pet peeve as a coach are excuse makers. And I learned this very early in high school. I worked at a school. We ran a version of an option. And I remember one time the right guard went to the wrong blocking assignment. I pulled the kid off. I was getting ready to really let loose. And I said to him, son, he goes, coach, I missed him. I go, what? Yeah, I know who I have. I'm supposed to have the inside backer on that. I missed him. Okay, don't miss him anymore. Get back in there, which was the exact right approach for him to take. And it's something that I wish more people in life, including in football, would take. When you screw up,
own it.
And we all do, just say, hey, look, I blew it.
Yeah.
So it's pretty hard as a coach to get angry at somebody or miffed or even more than amused when they did everything in their power and the other player just beat them.
Yeah.
I mean, it happens.
Yeah.
If guard can't handle nose guard or linebacker, then we're going to have to switch our assignments and double team that person so that we can be successful. So it falls on us as coaches to make those adjustments to negate their advantage.
Gotcha. All right. My next question would be, what advice would you give to 25-year-old Rick?
Stay in the Air Force. The Gulf War is just around the corner.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
You don't mean that? Okay. I thought you wanted honesty. That's what I would have said. But
are there any things you would have done differently?
Oh, there's a thousand things, Jerry, I would have done differently. There's a thousand things personally, professionally, emotionally. Yeah, I mean, I think I'm as imperfect a human being as I've ever met. So, yeah, there's a thousand things I'd do differently. I'm not sure I'm going to confess them on the radio. But, you know, I'm not Catholic. I don't think it's good for my soul to confess.
Yeah.
Although I always told my former clients that it was good for them to confess to me. But and most of them did. But no, there's a lot I wish they would have done. A couple of things that I wouldn't change is my competitiveness. Mm-hmm. If you're going to succeed in life, and I don't care what it is, from tiddlywinks to owning a bank, you better be competitive.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't be competitive, then you're probably in the wrong line of work, i.e. life. A couple of great quotes I remember, but I changed the words. Basically, you should be competitive in all things. I think Robert E. Lee said, duty is the sublimest word in the English language. You should do your duty in all things. One can never do more. One should never do less, and I truly believe that.
Yeah.
You should do your duty, whether it's taking out the trash or merging with AT&T, you should be competitive at what you choose to do. And I'm sadly competitive. I don't know if you picked up on that.
Yes, you are. I appreciate that about you. I'm the same way. So my next question would be, who do you admire as a coach and or human being? Who's on your list of people you really admire a lot?
Well, started out without saying much more than I admire my older brother and father. Mm-hmm. I admire Chuck Yeager. I admired Neil Armstrong. I admired Richard I. Bong. So there's some names for your listeners to go look up. Those are guys that were tried and tested in the most severe ways and overcame every obstacle that was placed in front of them and did great things for not only what they were doing at the moment and their service and their nation, but in most cases for mankind as a whole. I admire Jonas Salk. There are just so many people that I have stolen from over the course of time, attributes that I've taken from some of the most insignificant or least spoken about historical figures. I think Genghis Khan was probably a pretty competitive dude.
Yeah.
That's the type of person that I look to gain insight and knowledge from, and it's what I hope I'm passing on. It's what our entire coaching staff hopes we're passing on to our players. Because as it stands today, none of our women, not one of our players,
mm-hmm.
on our team or any team we've played, is going to play professional football.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you know that these young ladies are not going to end up owning the bank, then you should be imparting knowledge, skills, and wisdom above and beyond the X's and O's of the football field.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we do that pretty well on our team.
Gotcha.
Every Tuesday, before we start our warm-ups, we do pimple popping. And the pimple popping is when anybody who has a gripe about anything, whether it's playing time or somebody said something nasty to me at the fifth quarter or so-and-so snores when we're on the bus, is spoken about. Because we have a rule that if you can't bring it up at pimple popping, you can't bring it up at all. If you haven't got the guts to stand up and say this, then quit whining in the background. Quit being that white noise that so many teams have. And you see it a lot in high school football. Johnny's mommy is up there in the stands and is all upset because Johnny should be the starting quarterback. This is Johnny. Your son is a booger eater. Just be thankful he's on the team. He's having fun. He's learning stuff. But he's just not very good. Don't get all riled up. So, anyway, no, there's all sorts of stuff I'd tell 25-year-old Rick, but I knew 25-year-old Rick, and I know that bastard wouldn't have listened.
All right. It's a fair answer. So my last question for you before we get out of here is, what do you, and this is something I just thought about recently, you know, I've been coaching women's football, well, football in general, for about 6 to 7 years, and as you said earlier, you've been coaching football for close to 30. What would you say is the best advice for a coach, you know, that's coaching against, you know, other coaches that have been coaching a lot longer, right? So there's no substitute for experience. You know, you've probably seen it all. You obviously know your offense very well. That's back of your hand. You see what teams can do against your offense, and you know there's a counteract to everything that people do. But what would you say is the best advice for a younger coach that hasn't been coaching as long, going against, you know, coaches like yourself that have been coaching a lot longer and just seen a lot more things? Do you think there's anything to speed up that process or to catch up, or just it is what it is, and you know you're going to get there eventually, maybe? You know, once some years have passed.
I mean, that's very complicated. I think there are some incredibly talented young coaches out there. And guys that are learning their trade and putting more clues into their clue bag. That's what we called it as pilots. You had a clue bag that you would steal from other people, put into your clue bag, and the way you flew your airplane was based on your clues. That as you as a young coach are watching your opponents, you want to steal from your opponent that which will help you with your own game, your own game plan, your own theory of football, and discard the part of that coach that you don't like. And there are many, many examples of that, of being able to take the good and ignore the not so good, and thereby increase your effectiveness. I know that one of our primary objectives on our team is to eliminate the other coaching staff from the game itself. So a lot of the things that we do is based upon the fact that we want to try to keep this game 16 or 17 versus 11. So our five defensive coaches versus the 11 offensive opponent players on the field. Mm-hmm. So we do a lot of different things in an effort to eliminate or minimize the effect that the other coaching staff can have on their own players. So, you know, we do a number of little tiny things like that that we hope gives our players an advantage. I think the biggest thing that a young coach can do is to learn how to get 30 to 53, since that's the number, and it's the highest roster we've ever had, despite what you've heard, is 53.
So, okay.
To get those 30 or 53 players to believe in you. If you can get them 100% eating at your table, you're going to be a lot better on the field than you would be otherwise. The ability to get a group to pull as one. You know, I think back, we've had a couple of pretty dandy little running backs. I had one in particular that was incredibly efficient, but she was lucky to touch the ball in regular season games 5 or 6 times. We played one game against a nearby adversary where our starting quarterback got 8 plays in the entire game. That's all she got, were 8 plays. She's the starting quarterback. She played 8 plays. So that ain't easy, because if you're the starting quarterback, by definition, you got a little bit of spring in your step, right? Everybody's starting quarterback does.
Yeah.
But she understood that for the team, for the other 52 players, her only playing 8 meant more to the team than her playing 60 plays and scoring 27 touchdowns, averaging 15 yards a pass or 15 yards a rush. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, comes from the culture of the team. You've got to build your culture to where team is first, second, and third.
Gotcha. Fair enough. Well, yeah, last thing I want to offer you, Rick, before I let you go is to plug. And so if you want to plug your team's website or Facebook page or whatever social media, or I know you guys have a cool game coming up here in Vegas, you know, my platform's yours, so have at it.
I'm not sure that they're, you know, I'm not a social media guy, so I don't of that social media. Some of it does get forwarded to me. Players have figured out how to cut and paste the most inflammatory thing another person or team has said so that we can use it to our advantage.
Yeah.
But, and then that's where I'll take it and add to it, make it even worse. But, you know, because that's what I do. I don't have any plugs for that. I would say that the Hall of Fame game coming up in December is a really good and fun event. It's, you know, there are, I think, 50 players from the East and 50 players from the West that are going to meet, and players that would never get a chance to play against one another, they're going to meet new coaches, they're going to learn new things, and they're going to play against women that they've heard about, and in some degrees maybe even idolized, and they're going to play on the same field with them or against them. And that's a pretty cool deal. It's not USA football. It's not touted as USA football. Mm-hmm. It doesn't diminish anybody else's All-Star, Hall of Fame, Team USA, Team WFA, or what have you. It doesn't diminish any of those. It doesn't take away from or in any way harm any of those things. And so it's a pretty fun thing to be a part of. Like you said, you had, you came and helped one year. Mm-hmm. I think it was great for the players to meet the man behind the beard as much as it was for you to meet the woman behind the face mask.
Yeah.
You know, they're just good events. I think the, you know, the biggest thing is women's football spends so much time tearing one another down that there's no way it's going to grow to what everybody wants it to grow to, because we're too busy picking on each other. We're too busy saying, oh, those guys did this and that's why they're good, or those guys did this and that's why they won, or those guys participated in that and that isn't as good as this. And as soon as we could get rid of that, I do think there is a place for the sport. I do think that as far as a sport that people could get behind and participate in and have a true fan base and therefore a true professional league starts with the way it is offered currently. We've got to stop worrying about why they've done so well as much as I constantly think about Dallas and Boston. I do that only in the sense, can I steal something from them to make us better? And that would be my one big plea is, hey, quit tearing down each other. One of the players on my team told me once, women would rule the world except for women. I stopped and go, what? We rule the world, but we spend so much time tearing each other down that we're never going to be able to rule anything.
Yeah.
I go, huh, I've never really thought of it that way. And it's very true. The sport needs to stop worrying about if you're in the AFL or the NFL or the CFL and start worrying about what can we do to make our sport exciting, attractive, and fun for somebody else to come and plunk down their $10 to sit in a high school stadium and watch. It doesn't do any good to sit in a professional or college stadium with 750 people you may as well sit in a high school stadium and save yourself a couple of bucks, mm-hmm. or at least make it look like you have a pretty good crowd. And so we're doing things that I think are detrimental to our sport. I don't think that's the intention of either league administration, league owners, whatever you want to call it. I don't think there's any cabal out there. I just think it's one of those things where we're not seeing the forest from the trees. And the sooner we get to that point, and this will happen well after I'm long gone from coaching this sport. But that would be my advice is let's start reveling in our successes and start trying to build something a little bit greater instead of denigrating or putting down somebody else's success or blaming or making excuses for our lack of success. Mm. You know, it's the funny thing about, you know, war. We can all bitch and complain that Pearl Harbor occurred on a sneak attack. But the war began. Now, what are we going to do? Are we going to go complain, hey, that's not, you guys snuck attack? That's not fair, so we win the war? It's not the way it works. You've got to go out and get better and build and get stronger and overcome whatever adversarial thing has been put in your way.
Gotcha. It does. It does.
All right, Terry, thank you so much for the time. Hopefully you can wake up most of your listeners.
Fair enough, Rick. Well, I appreciate your time, man. It's always great talking to you. I'm probably going to have you on at least one more time here in the future because there's other stuff I want to touch on with you just to pick your brain a little bit. But maybe we could do that next year before the season or after the season. And so if you're up for it.
Well, I'll give you my West WNFC rankings right now if you want them.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to go with Seattle, San Diego Rebellion, Los Angeles Bobcats, and the Falcons in that order.
That's hilarious. All right.
Oh, that's the way I think. I think those three teams are, Seattle obviously has the superior coaching staff. I think that San Diego should benefit greatly from the surge. I think Los Angeles hit their stride last year and is going to take leaps this year, and I think, you know, we're always a pain in the butt, so we'll be hanging around somewhere to get into the playoffs.
That's a very modest take. We'll see how it plays out, but I wish you guys all the best. I'm a fan of your team. Like I said, I love your players. I've met a lot of them in person, and so the only time I don't root for you guys is when you're playing my team. I appreciate your time, man. We'll talk soon, okay?
All right, Coach. Good luck.
I'll see you, Rick.
Bye-bye.
And there you have it. That was my interview with Rick Rasmussen, head coach of the Utah Falcons. Pretty awesome interview. I really enjoyed it. Like I told him, I could have asked him 10 more questions, and so I'd definitely like to have him on again just to talk more. There's a lot of wisdom in talking to people that are older than you, years-wise and, you know, as a coach. He's been coaching for 30 years. I've been coaching for 6 or 7 years. And so it's a pretty big discrepancy as far as, you know, the difference. And so I would definitely be very foolish to not acknowledge that and to seek out as much wisdom as I can get from people that have been in the game longer and in life longer. You know, they just, you know, with age, people just learn things. And if you can get little nuggets from people to learn those things now instead of learn the hard way later, you know, you should do that. And so, anyways, thanks for joining me, guys. It was great to have you. Hopefully you enjoyed the podcast, and I'll see you guys next week. Have a great weekend.